Did you know that there are over 3.2 million podcasts in the world? It seems like everybody these days has a podcast. But did you also know that 90% of those podcasts fail to make it to 20 episodes? There are various reasons for these failures, but one reason is that people don't know what they're doing. Shocking, right? As it turns out, the same reason why people don't operate on themselves also applies to podcast success. You want to talk to someone who has had success launching and marketing podcasts. Somebody like Juliana Barbati. Juliana runs a podcast marketing and production agency, and their team takes care of everything for you, making this process a breeze. All their info is in the show notes. You can go to julianabarbati.com, tell them TGFB sent you, and get a discount when paying in Bitcoin. That's right. Juliana is a Bitcoiner. Her and her husband were actually Bitcoiners before they were Christians. And so it's been great for us to work with them. They basically came to us and said, hey, we'd love to help you guys, help TGFB grow. And so we'd love to kind of apply our services to you guys. So go ahead and support them. If you have a podcast you're working on or one that you'd like to start, go ahead and check them out. Now let's get to today's show. All right. Douglas Wilson is a Christian and has pastored Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho for the past 40 plus years. He is the godfather of the classical Christian school movement, the founder of Logos Christian School, New St. Andrews College. He's a prolific author of too many books to count, including the book, Is Christianity Good for the World?, which he authored alongside the late Christopher Hitchens. He's a social critic, a troubler of Israel, a man of Issachar, the husband over 45 years to Nancy, the father to Nate, Rebecca, and Rachel, and grandfather to 17 grandchildren. And a
18,
spiritual father.
18 now.
18. You got one more. I almost asked you. And a spiritual father to many more. Douglas Wilson, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here.
So I just want you to know ahead of time, I've told you this, I think at least once, but when I thought about who I could have on this podcast, you are literally number one at the top of the list. So we're starting out at the top. I don't know where we go from here, but... So one of the things that I just want to talk to you about, I listened to a number of things that you've done and talked about economics. And one of the most recent things that I watched was an interview that you did with a hedge fund manager named David Bahnsen, who's the son of Greg Bahnsen, obviously. He has a program with National Review called No Free Lunch, which I'd highly commend to our audience. We'll have the link in the show notes. But one of the things that you said in that interview that I think will be a good through line for this entire conversation was this statement. You said that money is the circulatory system in any body politic. Can you explain a little bit of what you meant by that and why you believe that to be the case?
Yes, because we are not disembodied spirits, because God created the heavens and the earth, it is necessary for us to communicate with one another and love one another through media. You can't take a bunch of disembodied spirits and throw them into an empty vacuum and have them radiate love vibes at each other. Basically, in order for me to give a gift, I've got to make the gift, I've got to wrap it, I've got to carry it in my hands and extend it to someone else, and then they take it with their hands. Now, what money does is it reduces the friction in that sort of transaction. It used to be if I wanted somebody's cow or I wanted to buy a quarter of a side of beef, I had to give him 17 chickens. And that gets cumbersome. And so the advantage of money is that it's portable, fungible. You can apply decimal points to it and so forth. So what it is sort of a clearinghouse of mutual giving and receiving. So you translate the side of beef into funds and you translate the chickens into funds, and then you just transact it that way. So if you had brain bigger than what we've got and you were able to see all the economic transactions, you would see a large portion of what's going on. You would see the circulatory system of that culture in the exchanges that were made.
Yeah. And so honestly, one of the things that makes me think about is, I think you could honestly say that money serves in a very real sense, a priestly function within a society. Like it's this thing that allows intercession between people. It allows, you can honestly think about the role of a priest in an economic way, right? You have the priest is kind of the money who'd be interceding between God and man to give both sides of the transaction something that they both want.
Yeah. I use the word media. But that's not that far removed from mediator. It's a mediating function between purchasers and sellers, gift givers and gift receivers.
Yeah. Another thing, there's so many different things that money does, or, you know, different components to what makes up money, or at least good money. When one of those things is a store of value, you know, just the idea of inherent in the idea of money is that you have to do something to earn it. You have to provide value. You're given something of value in exchange for value that you provide. Right. And this is why something like, we don't use something like sand or dirt for currency, because I can go and accumulate those things without any work or self-denial being done at all to provide those things. Yeah.
That means the money has to have a certain element of scarcity.
100%.
Scarcity is one of the features.
Yes, absolutely. Hopefully this will not be your last time on this podcast. And so I'd love to go through and you know, we could talk about a bunch of things and go down a bunch of different rabbit holes as relates to money. But one of the other things that you talk about in that excellent interview with Mr. Bonson is the idea that there are currencies that are far beyond just money itself. There are a number of different currencies. And one of the things you talked about was the idea of social capital. Could you kind of unpack what you mean by that term? And because again, I don't think that's something that's intuitive. It's not something that we think a lot about or are presented with very much. So can you unpack the idea of what you meant by?
Sure. What I meant by social capital, I'll illustrate it with a minor illustration of it, not minor to me, but and that is, what dollar value could I possibly place on all the things my father taught me, right? I find myself in a situation and I think of something my dad would say, or I find myself quoting him or mimicking him or imitating him in a situation. Well, that really is part of my inheritance from him, but it wasn't a physical inheritance. So that's what I mean by social capital. Now, if you zoom out to that's a very important thing to me, but it was a smaller subset of the social capital of religious capital, moral capital, the sorts of things that when the gospel takes root in a society, in a culture, and the people have acknowledged the God of the Bible for multiple generations, there are certain things that just become part of the atmosphere. It's part of what you do. So one of my favorite illustrations of this would be the power goes out in a major city and all the drivers at a four-way traffic light, at a traffic light intersection, they just voluntarily turn it into a four-way stop sign. That does not happen in nature. That does not happen by itself. It's inculcation over many generations of teaching kindergartners to stand in line. That's moral. That's moral capital. You have to learn it. And upstream from all of it is the gospel.
And so I think this is one of the things that we've seen definitely over the last, I mean, I would say going back to at least the great financial crisis in 2008, and then even more so, it was even more heightened and more pronounced over the last 3 years during the whole COVID fiasco. You see the cost of the dissolution of that social capital, the breakdown, what happens when that trust is broken down, and you start to see the value and how it's not anywhere near as easily replaceable or rebuildable as maybe the money itself that was, you know, 40% of all of the dollars that have ever existed were created since 2020 as a result of, you know, both President Biden and Trump, you know, printing and doing these, you know, airdropped handouts to everyone. So that currency or money, you know, sorry, excuse for money, but that money is able to be created and reproduced very easily and quickly, whereas the social capital is not. Given the situation that we're in, what's our course of action? Like, what do you see as something? How do we start rebuilding that?
All right. One of the things that I'm fond of saying is that reality is not optional. And that means in the long run, stupidity never works. Yeah. So you can jump off a cliff in the conviction that you can fly. And if you're delusional enough, you might actually take the leap. But at some point in the proceedings, reality, meaning the rocks below, will reassert itself. And that means sometimes when I look at all the nonsense that's going on in clown world, I think what America really needs right now is a famine, because there's a lot of foolishness that is going on because of the abundance and the relative security that we have. You can afford to throw money around because you think or believe that there's an endless supply of it, but there is not. there's not an endless supply of it. And that's Margaret Thatcher's great comment. The problem with socialism is sooner or later you run out of other people's money. And that means is the people who are investing, who are taking real value of the product of their work and finding places to store that wealth. They're also going to figure out ways to hide that wealth that they've stored, to hide it from the predators.
Sure.
And when the predators no longer have access to it, the party's over.
No, 100%. And so another quote that you had in along these same lines or during this the same interview, you said, virtue reinforces the markets and the markets ought to reinforce virtue. This idea of, and this is, again, adding more on that idea of social capital. I mean, I think if you ask the average Christian or the average pastor today what his role should be and how much he should be thinking in these terms or thinking about the instruction that he would give to his congregation as relates to about the topic of economics or markets or any of these things, that probably wouldn't be in their top 20 things of one of their top 20 things that they would be talking about their congregation with. One of the other things that you mentioned, you said pastors should be educating themselves in basic economics. We're giving a hearty amen to that here. Our audience would give that a hearty amen. Why do you think it's important for Christians generally and even pastors to be thinking about these things and to be thinking about communicating these ideas to their congregations?
Yeah, I think it's crucial because, well, there's a number of reasons, but for one, it gets pastors out of their ivory tower, because what happens is the pastor's actual task is to take the word of God, which is timelessly true in every generation, and apply it and proclaim it to the people where they are, which means that the pastor has to be bilingual. He has to understand the thought world, thought forms of the scripture, but he also has to understand what's going on in people's lives. And what's going on in people's lives are, as commonly called in political campaigns, are kitchen table issues. What do I do? My job is threatened. What do I do about what HR is going to do to me if I continue to go to this church? What am I going to do about retirement? What am I going to do about should my kids take care of me? There's a host of questions that the Bible has answers for in principle. Deuteronomy says nothing about your 401k, but the Bible does have principles that apply to your situation. And it's the pastor's responsibility to be the interpreter between those two worlds. So he can't just go into the library and study the worldview of the ancient Near East and then give learned lectures in the library about this arcane subject that a handful of people in his congregation are interested in. He has to preach to them where they live. How does the gospel affect your day-to-day life?
And I definitely think that is part of the risk. And that's part of the, just a lot of what we've seen is just there does seem to be this disconnect between pastors and the people that they're ministering to, because there's not people speaking authoritatively or intelligently about the, you know, in an informed way about economics, mm-hmm. about things like monetary policy, things like, you know, just the ways that, and again, this is something we talk a lot about in Thank God for Bitcoin in our world, is just currency devaluation. What does this look like? Why does this happen? And so the name can be deceiving. So we have the name Thank God for Bitcoin. But really what it is it's half of our whole goal and mission is basically help Christians understand why sound money matters, and then help them see that, you know, in our mind, like Bitcoin is sound money. One of the other things you mentioned in this regard is that this neglect of pastors speaking about these issues and being comfortable and bold in speaking about economic issues is somewhat of a recent thing. You mentioned that several hundred years ago, the Christian clergy played a pretty crucial role in helping reinforce the importance of sound markets. Can you give some examples of that? That would be helpful.
Yeah, it'd be largely in the early first half of the 19th century. One of the things that was very striking about the evangelical and Protestant clergy at that time is how educated they were in economics and how forcefully they argued for it in the public square. So your listeners probably don't need to be told this, but free market economics is not the same thing as what I call crapitalism, where crony capitalism or being in government, being in bed with big corporations, that's not free market economics.
No.
So these men were in the first half of the 19th century very important figures in sort of establishing the ethos of markets and free markets in the American DNA. It would come out in their writings, their books, sermons, that sort of thing. It was very, very striking.
Can you just give maybe one or two examples of pastors or Christian thinkers who spoke along those lines?
I'm going to give you a very vague answer. Okay. It's in a book. I can probably look it up while we're talking here. Okay. A book. It's a history of the Mexican, the American-Mexican War, which occurred in the first half of the 19th century. There's a big section on the role of evangelical Protestant clergy in that whole political setup. So I don't have any, I don't have names on the tip of my tongue, but there's this, I'll have to find that book.
It's fine. We can put it in the show notes afterwards. Okay. So no worries.
All right.
I will say one of the ones, have you read the book, The Ethics of Money Production by Jörg Guido Holzmann?
I have not.
Book? Okay. No. So he's a Roman Catholic Austrian economist. He wrote this book. And basically the function of this book is to popularize the writings of a 15th century bishop, Catholic bishop named Nicolas Oresme. And so basically this guy in the 1400s was standing up to princes who were trying to devalue the currency by adding in more base metals into the silver and in the gold. And so basically what he's doing, it's just money, modern day in today's, you know, parlance, that would be, it's just money printing. He's enabling the monetary supply and his own power to grow. And so one of the things that Nicolas Oresme did, he appealed to this very obscure Old Testament passage that says, thou shalt not steal.
Tell me more about this religion of yours.
So, I mean, just for our other listeners out there, that Nick Oresme is a great voice. And part of what we see our work in is helping Christians, again, translate, because no one's going to tell you, no politician or no governmental authority is going to sit here and tell you that they're stealing from you. You know, they're going to hide it in all kinds of different ways, you know, in terms that sound, you know, highfalutin and all these things like baseline inflation, all these things, you know, it's easy to hide this immoral activity. And so as Christians, we want to drag these things kicking and screaming into the light and then help Christians see the biblical reality, how what the scriptures would call these things rather than the ways that they're hidden by people in modern day.
Absolutely.
Just one of the other things that I've read through and or watched, I guess, a number of times was a sermon that you did. It was entitled Young Men and Their Strength. And so one of the things that you see, one of the things that you talk about in that sermon is the relationship between sex and economics. And so this is something, a lot of times this is something of a taboo, and this is something that the secular world will often try to use this as a gotcha for Christians. And they'll talk about, you know, Christians, you treat women like they're, you know, property, and you treat women as if they're cattle. And, you know, and so, you know, basically saying that, you know, you treat this like it's more just an economic function, or you're not recognized that it's an economic function. And so the thing I love about this sermon is like, you basically completely turned that on its head, and you're like, well, of course, sex and marriage are about economics. Everyone knows that. So can you kind of unpack a little bit about what you, just unpack your thoughts on that idea.
Yeah. So one of the things that modern feminists did is they attacked the institution of marriage as simply a glorified form of prostitution. They said, okay, see, there's a financial exchange and there's a sexual exchange, and how's that different from prostitution? Yeah. Well, the thing that makes it different is that your entire life is involved in it. So what prostitution does is detach the money and the sex and leaves out the car seats and the minivan and the white picket fence and the lawn to mow and the mortgage payment. It leaves out all the rest of your life. So, of course, human lives, I said earlier that money is the circulatory system of a society, and sex is certainly part of that society. Yeah. So you can't just say, well, the circulatory system doesn't reach certain aspects of our lives. No, of course, it permeates everything. So what I want to argue is that sex is inherently an economic reality and has economic repercussions. The child that you beget must be fed, and the food costs something, and there's no way to escape it. And so consequently, you want to make sure that you sort of face up to the implications of all this honestly, and that you take into account the total picture. And here's the one time I used to have a weekly column for a public radio station many decades ago across the border, WSU. And I got fired from that gig for what I'm about to say.
Doug, you got fired.
I got fired because I said something on the air that was just, but what I said on the air was this, and this is something I learned from the great George Gilder. So, and that is that men and women, taking them together, men are dominant. And they're going to be dominant no matter what you do. There's nothing you can do to erase that dominance. The only thing you can do through misbegotten policies is make that dominance destructive instead of constructive, right? Your choice is not between whether men will be dominant or not. Your choice is going to be whether men are going to be dominant constructively or whether they're going to be dominant destructively. Yeah. Now, in order to enlist men into constructive dominance, there has to be some sort of an exchange, right? And marriage is a building block of all stable societies. And in order to get men to commit to marriage, and in order to get women to commit to marriage, they're both giving something up. Yeah. And they both need to be receiving something. Yeah. And the way the world is constructed, because it's not a level playing field. The way the world is constructed in a monogamous society where marriage is honored, men are going to give up more, at least on the surface. Mm-hmm. Okay. In order to be, and so what society did is they said, look, if you give up your freebooting piratical Viking ways and devote yourself to one woman, take care of her, take care of the children you beget, what you have, what happens there, when the man submits his sexual cycle to the woman's, civilization happens. When it goes the other way, when women submit their sexual desires and cycle to the male, the fallen but male desires, what you get is the civilization building power of a motorcycle gang. It's a boatload of Vikings. So what happens is all of this is tied in with economics. If a man is given honor and respect, and the right to contribute constructively. And in exchange, he has access to a sexually fulfilled life with one woman. The end result is culture, civilization.
I think one of the other things you point out in that sermon is just the idea that, you know, we haven't taken away the transactional nature of sex. We just have put it in different forms.
Right.
So you have, you know, you have the premium subscription to Bumble or whatever the dating site is, you know, you're paying for extra access or extra privileges. And so, you know, it might not be the Yenta or something, or, you know, your parents who are arranging marriage. You're entrusting yourself to others. And those others, ironically, do not have all of the same incentive alignment that you did when you did have, you know, people who were your parents or other, you know, other relatives, you know, doing those, you know, arranging those type of transactions, because they're going to be directly inheriting the consequences of a good or bad match. And so it makes a lot of sense that you'd want someone who was, you know, related to you, you know, being the one who, in an ideal situation, you obviously have bad situations.
Right.
But, you know, all things being equal, the incentives tend to align more in that kind of a situation.
Yes. One of the things I'm fond of, saying is the state that in a modern statist society, they want to encourage a radical individualism, because individuals are like the illustration I use are like BBs, and you put a bunch of BBs in a sack and it doesn't have any structural rigidity. And then they try to foment things like massive amounts of pornography and pot smoking and stuff, which is to pour grease into the, you know, oil into the BBs and make them even slipperier. Yeah. In a biblical society, the BBs form molecular connections. So a husband and a wife and a church community and a family, a tribe, a region. And the more complex molecules form, the more structural rigidity there is that is able to resist the state.
That is absolutely the case. And again, that's something that goes as far back as Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, you have the serpent trying to empower humanity, you know, by saying, you know, look at all these, look at the, you know, take responsibility for yourself, make these choices. And in reality, you know, their liberty came at the cost of enslaving themselves to him, and enslaving all the rest of us with him. I definitely think that is, again, you could very easily make the case that, you know, the modern secular state is of their father, the devil. And again, we could talk about all these for so long, but I definitely just want to, you know, I want to keep getting these quick hitters. I would love to talk with you about is money and education. This is one of the points at which when I heard about Christchurch, about New St. Andrews, I was most impressed. Can you just talk a little bit about that and the relationship between you guys and the state in terms of, I guess, in terms of New St. Andrews? Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So we resolved when we founded New St. Andrews that we were not going to take one thin dime from the state because, as the old saying goes, he who takes the king's coin becomes the king's man. And there are always strings. And even if the people sponsoring the legislation for the handout promise and put in the bill, there are no strings. There's absolutely nothing in our legal system that prevents a subsequent legislature from coming in and attaching all the strings. And when they come in 5 years later and attach all the strings, now your budget is dependent upon whatever that was. We decided that we were going to just stay free from that in principle. So we don't accept government money. We don't accept state money. We don't have a program where the students can come on student loans. Basically, we don't investigate where somebody got their money, but we don't do any cooperative thing where we cooperate with the government in any way.
Yeah, I just think that is just so powerful and such a in the Bitcoin world, one of the things that's talked about is time preference. Are you familiar with this idea of like low time preference versus high time preference? Low time preference is basically made thinking, you know, farther into the future, so like generationally or, you know, dozens of years, whatever. And then high time preference is basically I'm making decisions for today. And right. It just seems to me that that idea and that form or principle in decision making is what is driving most everybody these days is where can I get the quick dime today rather than stopping to take a minute and think about where is this going? And so I just think you guys are to be commended both for obviously, you know, honoring the Lord and then for providing, showing the rest of the Christian world like an option that is, especially as things get crazier and crazier in clown world, you guys are providing a different option for Christians.
The TGFB podcast is brought to you by the TGFB 24 conference. Thank God for Bitcoin 2024 is happening July 24th and 25th in Nashville. This conference brings together some of the best minds in the church, the academy, and in Bitcoin to explore the biblical foundations and daily consequences of how money affects the incentives and outcomes of the world we live in. The name of the conference this year is Render to God, Stewardship, Dominion, and the Economics of Glory. We figured that an election year was the perfect time to examine the relationship between God, government, and money. We'll dive deep into what the Bible has to say about what money is, the role it plays in society, and why the principles governing money creation have such a huge and yet underappreciated effect on every aspect of our world. I'll be speaking alongside pastors and respected Christian figures like C.R. Wiley, Thomas Terry, Eric Hirschman, Glenn Sunshine, and many more. Tickets are limited, so use promo code TGFB24 to save 10% today before prices increase. You can also, for a limited time, if you would like to bring your wife with you, we would love for you to do that. We would love husbands to be able to bring their wives, and so we are offering 80% off tickets for wives who want to accompany their husbands. So that means you can get two tickets today for $300 by using promo code COUPLE at checkout at tgfb.com/store. Go ahead, run over and do that. We'd love to have husbands and wives together to talk about these very important topics. This is a one-of-a-kind community experience at the intersection of theology, technology, ethics, finance, and economics. We hope to see you there. Okay, back to the show.
So not only do you have kids who love the Lord and who are out there doing things for the Lord and doing all kinds of incredible things, they went and married people who are you know, pretty incredible and doing lots of things for the Lord as well. So your son-in-law, Ben, who I've had the privilege to talk with a few times about what you guys are doing out at NSA, you and him together, and there may have been somebody else involved, published a document that's called Saving Culture by Restoring the Liberal Arts. And so I read through that a number of months ago now, and found myself heartily amening all throughout it. And one of the things that one of you wrote in there, you guys wrote and said, the lies and destruction we deal with today are a direct result of allowing one of the most trusted, revered, and protected parts of society, our educational system, to become thoroughly corrupted. Can you articulate and just kind of lay out a little bit more, maybe just that idea, build on that idea?
Yeah. One of the things that is important to note, this goes back to something you were saying earlier about the pandemic years, the COVID years. One of the things we've done is we have destroyed the people's trust in virtually every important institution in society. The military, higher ed, the CDC, corporate America. We've said, okay, we're going to annihilate your trust in everything. Yeah. And this has been very much the case in higher education. Basically, I would say the cancer that is spreading through our culture is spreading from the lymph nodes of higher ed. that's where the nonsense was first tolerated. Yeah. That's where the nonsense was nurtured at the beginning. Yeah. And then all the kids who are graduated from that system go out and take jobs in corporate America, go out into the military and so forth, and spread the cancer that way.
And I think a lot of this comes back to, and again, this is a topic that we talk about a lot, is a lot of this comes back to the fact that so much of higher education is so beholden to the government. You're at a point where they're so reliant on that government money to make things, you know, to run, to make things exist.
To survive.
Yeah. To survive. Yeah. You know, and then with the inflation that we've seen, and there's just a number of things. When inflation goes up the way that we've seen it, you know, rise precipitously the last, you know, few years, the inflation of home prices, the inflation of everything under the sun, you just have people who are closer and closer to that razor's edge, and they have to give over the incentive. They are incentivized monetarily, at least, to continue to give over and rely more and more on the nanny state, you know, on Big Daddy government. And so, again, I just think we're getting to a point. We've already been there, but we're definitely at a more closer to this edge of you're going to have to. Christians and churches and, you know, definitely Christian schools and universities are going to have to make tough choices if they're going to survive. And the reality is that many of them aren't surviving. Many of them are shutting down. It seems like every year that goes by, I'm seeing more and more. I mean, I was educated in a you know, Christian university, and every year that goes by, I see more and more of Bible colleges and universities, missions organizations closing down. And so, yeah, I just think this reality, I don't think people are, I think people are starting to see it, but I don't know that there's very many viable options that people see as, okay, this is what we're going to do. You know, you guys are definitely providing one of those. Like, what would you say to someone who sees all the problems, but maybe they're like, but what do I, you know, what do we do about this?
I would say if you've bought into the system, the loans and the guarantees and all of that, and you're just sort of up to your neck in that system, and you want to survive and you want to be faithful. Right. Yeah. So you want to be both, because every compromised institution at some point made a decision that it'd be better to continue on in existence than to martyrdom, than to be faithful. So you've got to be willing to go under faithfully. Yeah. But if you want to make it, if you want to shoot the moon and try to make it, and you want to be faithful, you need to start making plans now for laying off half your people. Okay. There's absolutely no way for you to detach yourself from the government teat. You can't do it unless you're willing to pay the price. And the price is going to be that free money, or that easy money is going to stop flowing.
Yeah. And I think another way that you see this fleshed out, again, you attributed a lot of the decay and a lot of the stuff that we're seeing, the craziness that's just become normalized in our world, putting that at the feet of a lot of these universities. And I think one of the things that we're seeing more and more is because we've gotten so, we just take it for granted the foundation, the gospel foundation that our country largely was built on. At least, you know, again, that's a whole fraught issue. But I mean, there's so many aspects of America's founding that it was just, these seeds came up in the ground of the gospel, in the ground of, you know, a certain vision of reality that the scriptures lay forth. And so what we're seeing right now is we're seeing a ton of people, there's identity crisis at every turn. Like we don't know what anything is. We don't know what government is. We don't know what people are. We don't know what, there's all these things of like, what is a church? You have all kinds of, I mean, you have like seeker friendly churches. You have all of these kind of different things. It seems like everywhere we look, there's identity crisis all over the place because we've stopped, you know, receiving our marching orders from the Lord. And so I don't see any, and I think you'd be the first one to agree with me. I don't see any way. I mean, the solution is you go back, you repent.
Yeah.
And you go back to the person who has defined the way the world is. We can't just keep defining these things for ourselves out of thin air.
Yeah, you go back to your father and say, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me a servant. You have to go back. Also, before I forget, to the book I couldn't put my finger on earlier, Missionaries of Republicanism. Okay. Missionaries of Republicanism, it's a religious history of the Mexican-American War, and it's by John Pinheiro, Pinheiro. Gotcha. But there's a good chunk in there about the economic savviness of these Protestant evangelical missionaries.
Oh, that's awesome. Man, thank you so much.
And pastors.
And pastors. That's awesome. Okay, so now we have about 15 minutes left. One of the things that I would be remiss if we didn't talk about was Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So now
aren't you going to talk about thanking God first and then thanking God and then Bitcoin?
Here we are. Yes. And so one of the things that we had the privilege of doing was being, we went to Podcaster Row at the Fight Laugh Feast conference that you guys did in Knoxville this past October. Again, we had just recently founded the business. We were like, okay, let's go find a Christian conference to go to. You guys, because of, you know, because of the similarities and just the shared foundations of the importance of things like sound money. And I know there's tons of people in your orbit who have read and you know, are very appreciative of somebody like Gary North's work. So we just figured, again, if we have a place where we can go and we don't have to make the two-part argument that we normally have to make, you know, normally our argument we have to show Christians is that sound money matters, and then we have to show them that Bitcoin is sound money. With you guys and your audience, we just felt like, okay, these guys already believe sound money matters. We just have to show them that, you know, try to show them that, make the case that Bitcoin is sound money. So we arrive, we are sitting there, we go in and we start setting up at our table. We find that we are right in front of the door. And so we find, you know, we have our giant banner that says, thank God for Bitcoin, right in front of the door. And so we took that as a hearty sign of improvement, approval from you guys' standpoint. So one of the other things that I found that week, the 4 days that we were there that I had no idea, was that NSA accepts Bitcoin as tuition. Now, one of the things that Ben told me was that you guys haven't had very many people, if anybody, you know, take them up on that offer at this point. But the very fact that you guys were willing to offer it was something that to me was super encouraging and super interesting. So I'm guessing you weren't part of the decision-making process, but let me just ask you, like, what do you think about Bitcoin? What do you know, or, you know, what are your thoughts?
All right, so there'd be different levels of it.
Okay.
So one level, the math level of it, I'd be no good at all at, right?
Yeah.
I don't code. So there's that. I'm aware of how it works at the general level. And the thing that I find appealing about the whole thing is that it's a place to store value that the government can't print. All right. So it's out of reach. So anybody who, if someone were to invent a way to put a computer server on the moon and we, and people could store their savings there, I'm in favor. I'm a big fan of getting the state out of those sorts of things. Now, there's one qualification, and that is Jesus says, don't store up treasures for yourself on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Now, every form of earthly wealth, well, I'll flip it around. No form of earthly wealth, Bitcoin included, is absolutely impervious to thieves breaking in and stealing. Someone could come and put a gun to your head and say, what's your password? And there you are. Yeah. But there's a difference between having a reasonable, prudent, you have your jewelry in a safe that only you have the combination to. That's much safer than leaving your jewelry on the dashboard of your car and leaving the car unlocked in the city. Okay. 100%. So basically, I would say that people who are investing in Bitcoin, I put scare quotes around investing, people who are utilizing Bitcoin are, I think, putting their resources in a safer place than most people are putting their resources. So then I would divide it into two categories. One is, am I investing in Bitcoin as though, you know, investing in it as a, like I would invest in the stock market, where I'm trying to play the game and get a return. So investing in Bitcoin would be one thing people could do. One approach. The other is they could just be putting savings away in Bitcoin as a hedge against tyranny, as a hedge against the pirates. So I'm a big fan of the hedge against pirates approach to Bitcoin, and I don't know enough to talk about the investment side.
I 100% appreciate that, and again, that's why we exist, is like to help Christians think through these issues. I think I will say one of the reasons this is so important, and just making this point, has nothing to do with Bitcoin in and of itself. It's got everything to do with a very particular lie that has been told for 100 years in 1913, since the Federal Reserve was founded, is the idea that, because when you start to divorce, when you start to introduce fiat currencies, what you're introducing, when you go from hard currencies to fiat currencies, you have currencies that are backed by actual work and investment. So like in the case of a currency, a place that uses gold as currency, what goes into the production of gold? You need to go dig it up in the ground. You need to pay people to dig it up in the ground. You need to refine it. You need to do all these things. So there's actual real world inputs that go into its production. And so in biblical terms, we would refer to this as sowing and reaping. Mm-hmm. Like God has created a world that is governed by principles of sowing and reaping.
Right.
And so in the Apostle Paul goes so far as to say that if, you know, God is not mocked, for what a man sows, he will also reap. So Paul says, he goes so far as to say that if you deny this foundational, you know, relationship between sowing and reaping, that this is how the world should and does work, you're mocking God.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, this is a big part of why fiat currency is problematic, because it fundamentally allows governments to act like they are God, who is the only one who can create ex nihilo. And so this is where this, where the value proposition is, especially for Christians, like beyond its uses, beyond the uses of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a currency that, just like gold, tells the truth about the nature of the world. It is mm-hmm. It humbles itself before the way that God has designed the world to function. And so again, one of the verses that comes to mind for me would be in Romans 1. Like Paul says, he talks about, you know, the pagans, and he says they refuse to acknowledge him as God or be thankful.
Right.
And so a big part of fiat currency and the way that it works, the way it comes into being, is mankind refusing to acknowledge the underlying realities of the world that God makes. And the way that fleshes itself out is, historically, sound currency or harder currency has been one of the checks on government tyranny. It's been one of the checks on endless war. It's been, you know, you run out of money at some point.
Yeah.
And obviously that's, you know, fiat money doesn't do away with that entirely, but it increases the gap. It increases the distance between seeing the sowing and reaping.
Yeah.
So we just basically see Bitcoin as something that is more aligned with the vision that God lays out for the way that the world actually is and the way that, you know, he actually works.
That's right. And so the longer you talk about that, the happier I get.
That makes me happy.
So
go ahead.
So what it boils down to is, you know, I'm going to be 70 next year, which means that a lot of these new things are learning curve issues for me.
Yes,
and 100%. Hours in the day, because a lot of my time and energy was invested in learning how to do things the old way.
Yeah.
But I've known for many decades that if I have a bunch of Federal Reserve notes, it'd be stupid to put them under my mattress. So what I've known that. So what I want to do is invest those notes into something that keeps the rain off. Or something that has actual value. And so if I had money and time and a flexible brain, I would have no problem investing in or buying Bitcoin. And and Bitcoin is the sort of thing that I'm just, okay, this is like gold. It acknowledges how God makes the world. Now, I've seen people who, would argue for the power of compound interest. David Bonson would be an example of that. He has shown, I think demonstrably so over the last generation, that gold was a bad investment. Okay. If, as opposed to, you know, you should have bought stock in thus and such instead of buying stock in gold. Well, yeah, but that would jump, that's toggling back and forth between the two tracks. Because I could see buying gold as an insurance policy.
Yes.
100%. Right. You know, I've been buying insurance for all these years. And the fact that I didn't have a heart attack doesn't mean that insurance policy was a bad idea.
Yes, 100%.
So basically, I think Bonson could prove to my satisfaction that gold was a poor investment on the returns. But it's still a good investment as a hedge against government tyranny.
And I 100% agree. I mentioned this joke to you, this meme. There's this meme that exists where it's got two guys from the show Star Trek, and there's this woman. It's like two frames. The first frame, this woman asks them, "Are you two friends?" And then in the bottom, one of them answers yes, and one of them answers no. So the Bitcoin guys, like, we appreciate the gold bugs. And so we're like, yes, we're friends with them. And the gold bugs, like,
no. Right. But me looking at it from the side, I would say it's that other meme where Pam from The Office is corporate wants you to find the difference between these two pictures. And it's the same picture. The government can't print gold, and the government can't print Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yes. Amen.
They're the same picture.
Amen. We're going to use that clip. The government can't print Bitcoin. We're going to use that and run with it. Yeah. One of the things, and again, we got another few minutes here, I think five or 6 minutes, but one of the things that, I think about you guys a ton. And because you guys have been planning and making wise decisions, generational thinking decisions, many could argue, because you guys are post-millennial, we won't go into that today, but we, you know, there's definitely some, you know, virtues there. That I think you could tie that relationship. But one of the things that, again, I think that you're right to point out, like, Bitcoin as an investment, that's one track. Bitcoin as tyranny, you know, insurance, that I think is increasingly becoming more and more something that Christians should be thinking about. Mm-hmm. And the thing that brought this to the fore in my mind, I had been hoping for something like this. Well, obviously not hoping for it. And then when it happened, I literally said, praise God. And that was the Canadian trucker protest.
Yeah.
Because what that revealed, the naked tyranny of the system, where the reality that this was already the case. This is already the case. If you read, you know, if you read the paperwork of, you know, when you deposit your money in a bank, the money ceases to belong to you. And so one of the things that came out of the Canadian protest was demonstrating that the money no longer belongs to you. You know, this money is not yours, and you can be cut off from your access to it in a blink of an eye.
Right.
And so as I think about churches and I think about churches doing ministry, I mean, you guys in Christchurch have been saving for, I'm guessing, a pretty long time to build a building. And, mm-hmm. and so we are in a world today where, you know, based on one sermon that you or, you know, Toby or, you know, somebody else preaches, you know, you guys can be debanked at the drop of a hat.
Right.
I know, like, part of the answer would be, you know, you don't store all of your, you know, money in banks, and you invest in a bunch of different things, and
right.
you know, you cross these bridges when you come to them. But that is a use in a lens that I think is helpful, and that more and more Christians and churches should be using to think about what Bitcoin is and the value proposition for it. That many of them are not thinking about at this point. They're still seeing the meme stock, you know, number go up. We're in for the, you know, the 100x gains or whatever. And they're missing out on that giant piece that, in my mind, is a gift from God, a timely gift from God, at a certain time and place in you know, redemptive history.
That's absolutely correct. Because why the big push for electric vehicles? So that somebody in the headquarters can turn them
100%.
Yeah. Turn them off. So if we live in a time when people want to ban gas stoves or foist electric cars on us or shut off the bank account of anybody who protests government policy in Canada, why not here? Everybody has to understand that we are currently living in a society that is tyrannical in principle. All the platform work, the staging work has been set for the exercise or the wielding of overt tyranny. And if you're not preparing for that, if you're a church, college, individual, and you're not preparing for it, you're not preparing for what's actually going to come at you.
You're not taking these governments and whoever else is involved, you're not taking them seriously when they're telling you who they are and they're telling you what they're going to do. They're showing you, and you're not believing them. I just think that's a big part. I'm going to close with this because this is something, obviously, I've been a missionary and church planter for 7 years in the country of Uruguay. We arrived in Uruguay. I knew very little about economics. We arrived there thinking that we were going to minister to very secular European Uruguayans. Uruguay is like this little piece of Europe, post-Christian Europe, that you just kind of wedged onto South America. And we get there and we're greeted. We arrive at the same time as 60,000 Venezuelan refugees who had their currency hyperinflated by their government. And so it was during that time where the value proposition of I had occasion to study and to understand the effects of currency devaluation, understanding the history of, especially in Latin America since 1971, when the US dollar detached from the gold standard, just understanding that almost every currency in Latin America has failed three or four times. And the effect that that has on churches and church planting, you have almost in Uruguay, very few churches can afford to pay their pastors. Very few churches can afford their own buildings. It just has a crippling effect on ministry and creates an outsized and unnatural dependence on outside missionary, you know, forces in the United States and the UK and other places. And so one of the things that you mentioned this idea of Bitcoin as something to help facilitate the future of global missions. I remember watching this video, you put it out. I just sat there in my car, just slack jawed, because it was literally, I believe, 3 weeks after we'd founded Thank God for Bitcoin. And with that being a big part of what we're doing, a big part of what we're trying to help churches and missions organizations, you know, see that reality and help them think through ways to combat it. Again, I know your understanding of Bitcoin in that regard is limited, but can you maybe go into a little bit kind of your thinking at this point of the relationship between Bitcoin and missions?
Yes, I'll just say two things here. One is, as you're selling Bitcoin to Christians, a lot of Christians, I think, over the last 2-3 years have been disillusioned by the establishment that was. So I think that you're going to have a much easier sell on the theoretical, theological side. Okay. What you're going to, the challenge is going to be, is on the practical side, because a lot of people are not investment geeks. They're not math people. Yes. So what you're wanting to do is, if someone rolled out a click and go approach to Bitcoin back in the day, as I've lived through the computer revolution, I would avoid the initial rollout of new software or spend less time on learning it. And I was waiting until the developers made it more user-friendly. Okay. Yes. Now, let's say you get to the point where it's user-friendly, and I've got some friends in I do have friends in Ukraine, let's say, and I want to give them some money. Yeah. And if I can open up my phone and in 30 seconds, give them some money, and I can do it without spending 3 weeks in a seminar learning how to do it.
Yeah.
The app is called How to Give Your Friends in Ukraine Some Money. And click here. Basically, any missionary anywhere in the world, you can look at your resources and you can transfer resources without having to deal with the friction of passports, customs, government regulations, anything like that. So basically, you are the only friction that you're dealing with is, is this a wise gift or not? And if I make the decision, yes, this would be a wise gift that would be greatly appreciated by this missionary or by this particular church on the ground, and I can do it, and there we are. Bob's your uncle.
Yeah. And the cool thing, again, for me is like that I'm like holding back to not just scream, is like all of those tools exist today. Like within something like Venmo, I don't know if you use that or not, but like within Venmo, within the Cash App or PayPal, like you can send Bitcoin, and it's literally that easy of just like either scanning a barcode or tapping a couple buttons. Like it exists. But to your point, like there's very few Christians are aware of this. Very few of the missions organizations are aware of this. A lot of them are starting to investigate this. I have a friend who's a missionary who his missions organization just approved a 3-year pilot program to investigate, you know, the use of Bitcoin around the world. And so there are some other challenges that come with it in terms of answering to government agencies about, you know, why you're sending Bitcoin into Russia, you know, or out of Russia or into the Ukraine or whatever. Like there are the potential for some of those kind of questions. But in terms of the actual technology and the usability of it, it's way more usable than I think a lot of people recognize. So
that's
part of our job, and our responsibility is to help Christians understand that. But
and I would say, go dog, go. Go fight, win.
Amen. Amen. Well, Pastor Wilson, thank you so much for your time. Thank you again for your ministry. And hopefully, again, this won't be the last time we have you on. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Our mission at TGFB is to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. We do this through podcasts, books, consulting services, and live events. We love giving away as much of our resources as possible, but we do have real overhead costs. And there are a number of easy ways that you can help us keep the lights on to continue our mission. First, if you're a Bitcoiner, you can listen to the podcast on the Fountain app and stream us sats in real time as you listen to the podcast. Every contribution makes a difference, no matter how small. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/TGFB to receive a number of special benefits available only to our Patreon supporters. If you find these conversations valuable, you can also help spread the word by sharing this episode, subscribing on YouTube, and leaving reviews on Apple and Spotify. Leaving us good reviews goes a long way toward ensuring that the algorithmic powers that be look favorably on our humble endeavors. And finally, engage with us on social media. Join the conversation so that we can build a strong community united around faith, freedom, and sound money. We mentioned the TGFB 24 conference on July 24th and 25th in Nashville. You can go grab your tickets at tgfb.com/store. And finally, go check out julianabarbati.com if you have questions about how to start or better your own podcast. We're grateful for your support, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.